for... Yeah, there's been a delay this evening. It wasn't intentional on Jim Farrington's part, but by challenging me and my directional virility, he forced us to get lost. But there was no computer here anyway. I am very happy that we have an evening session with Carrie. Carrie is one of the people that many of us met before. We met in person on 78L, who brought a lot of expertise that. Since then, I've learned that he's a co-producer of reissues and does professional copyright clearances for Hollywood and other legal copyright things. Probably the only person in the whole room who does legal copyright things. No, and like, we had a workshop about this earlier, but copyright forever is exactly right. No, you know, the Constitution says it can't be forever. Jack Valenti says it should be eternity less one day. That's his official position. Thank you very much. Thanks. Thank
you. Well, before we start, I just want to say, first of all, that this is my first ARSC conference. I've been wanting to go for many years. Mr. Beal has pleaded with me on several occasions. And I just want to thank David and Sam and everybody at UCSB for putting this wonderful program on. It has really been the time of my life, and I hope it has been for you, too. So let's hear it for the gang. And if we're ready, Barbara, you can hit the first.
We were going great guns out here before anybody ever heard of Nashville.
Now that was the voice of veteran country western performer Wesley Tuttle in reference to the long-standing love affair between California and American folk music styles, a tradition that goes back to the 1920s. In those days, folk and hillbilly music were interchangeable, both dealing with traditional songs performed by rural musicians and singers. The first hillbilly or folk recordings were made in June 1922 for the Victor label by a Texas fiddling champion named A.C. Eck Robertson. Within a few short years, dozens of rural artists had traveled to New York City to make records, followed shortly thereafter by field trips made by the major record companies to cities in the South and Southwest. Although Nashville didn't become a major recording center for country music until the late 1940s, the first California sessions were held in 1928, beginning with those made by Harry McClintock at the Victor Studios in Oakland. Victor was the first major record company to announce expansion in the West and opened its pressing plant in Oakland in May 1924. Brunswick had opened its first pressing plant in Los Angeles a few months before, and as early as June, Victor was making records in LA, with the first recordings made in Oakland issued that October. And as we heard this morning, most Oakland pressings by Victor can be distinguished by the small O located next to Nipper's head on the label. Harry McClintock was a self-described railroad boomer and hobo, born in Knoxville, Tennessee in 1882. He ran away from home at the age of 14, but not before developing a sympathy for hobos, learning their stories and songs, and eventually writing his own. He was working as a switchman and brakeman when he arrived in California in 1925 and got a job hosting a children's radio program on San Francisco's KFRC. Known as Haywire Mac, or sometimes just Radio Mac, McClintock made the first of his Victor sessions on March 1, 1928. He was the first artist to make recordings of such American folk classics as Red River Valley, Jesse James, and This Trail Song, which was first published by John Lomax in 1910.
As I walked out one morning for pleasure, I spied a cowpuncher a-riding along. His head was throwed back and his spurs was a-jingling as he approached me a-singing this song. Whoopie-tie-i-o, get along, little dogies, it's your misfortune, none of my own. Whoopie-tie-i-o, get along, little dogies, you know Wyoming will be your new home.
Traditional cowboy songs preceded the composed songs of the Hollywood Western on record by about a decade. Authentic cowboys such as Carl T. Sprague and Jules Verne Allen recorded many of these songs for Victor in the mid to late 1920s. Harry McClintock recorded them in the dry, dusty twang of the working cowboys. As you may have noted in the song that we just heard, melodies of some of the songs were somewhat different from those we are familiar with today, sung in a more modal style. This reflects the long and tangled history of these songs, some of whose ancestry has been traced back to 17th and 18th century England. Home on the Range is the best example of how melodies of cowboy songs have changed. The familiar melody was made famous by Bing Crosby in 1933. Here is what it sounded like on its first recording by cowboy singer Jules Allen in 1928.
The buffalo roam, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. Home, home on the range, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the clouds are cloudy all day.
Poor Jules. He missed out on the sky, but it's kind of refreshing to hear a different twist on that song. And a lot of the familiar songs that we know from those times sound different when they're sung by the people that actually learn them on the range. The Hollywood Bowl is the largest natural amphitheater in the United States, encompassing some 88 acres. Its first season of music was presented in 1922, and soon it became world famous for its magnificent natural acoustics. On September 1st, 1928, the summer season of the Hollywood Bowl's Symphonies Under the Stars came to an end with a live radio broadcast of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, performed by the Hollywood Bowl Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Eugene Goossens. The next day, the symphony returned to the bowl to make what would be the first outdoor recordings by a symphony orchestra. Equipment was shipped to Los Angeles from Victor's New York studios, especially for the session. On the morning of September 5th, the orchestra completed their third day of recording. At 2 p.m., onto the Hollywood Bowl stage sauntered Haywire Mack. Victor's A&R chief for the Western United States was Leroy Shield, who was best known for his scores for comedies made for the Hal Roach Studios. For some reason, Shield brought McClintock down to Los Angeles for a session, and finding the recording setup at the Bowl convenient, had Mack record two tunes that day. One, a test of a song called 50 Cents, and the other, a nonsense song called Ain't We Crazy. The first of the famous bowl shells wasn't erected until 1927. The pyramid-shaped temporary structure was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, crafted from the remnants of a wooden set used that year. In an attempt to improve the acoustical performance while achieving something aesthetically pleasing, Wright designed a new permanent shell the following year, which you can see here, consisting of 9 concentric segmental arches, which could be tuned panel by panel. The acoustic properties were considered a success, although the shell was declared unsafe because it was left out. It was apparently detractable, but they never detracted it. And it was demolished the following year. Recording in the bowl was somewhat problematic. Although the outdoor setting eliminated the closed room echo and barrel tones associated with previous orchestral recordings, the incessant chirping of the ever-present California mockingbirds made it necessary for a bowl worker to climb the surrounding trees to scare them away with a stick before recording could commence. The orchestra was scheduled to complete their session the next morning at 9 a.m., and at 7 o'clock in the morning, Mack returned to cut 2 more songs, including a tune he claimed to have written when he was 15 years old. In the early 1950s, McClintock talked about the song with folklorist Sam Eskin.
The song, originally, I wrote it when I was a kid. And it was the fairy stories. At that time, the ambition of every real hobo was to snare some kid to do his begging for him, among other things. And they used to tell the kids fairy stories about the lemonade springs and the Big Rock Candy Mountains and so forth, and there was some foundation. In fact, now, for instance, in Soda Springs, Idaho, there were at that time, and I guess still are, springs there that are so strongly, the water is so strong with soda that all you need is to a glass of water out of one of those springs and sprinkle a little lemon juice in it, and you have a very fine glass of soda water. And in Salt Lake City, not far from the OSL freight yards there, there's what was known as the chicken soup springs. It has some sort of a chemical content. It was a great place for the hobos to boil up or wash their clothes. And also the water had a sort of a flavor, you know. It might have been chicken soup. And in other words, there was a little foundation for the idea, but when I wanted to clean this song up, it wasn't a parlor song originally.
Well, do you remember what it was originally?
Yeah.
Well, how about singing the way it was originally, and then we'll do the clean version later.
Well, wait a minute. I don't believe I can do it offhand, Sam. I'd have to do a bit of thinking on that. I'll do the clean version.
All right, you do the clean version, and then we'll do the other.
Now, look, Mac. Hold on before we go to the next one, Barbara. Just a little comment on that interchange between Eskin and McClintock. You heard Eskin jump when he heard McClintock say this wasn't a parlor song. He wanted to hear what it was really like. And Norm Cohen has speculated that Big Rock Candy Mountains wasn't originally a song for kids. It was had something a little bit more illicit as to what the hobos would do with these young boys. I shouldn't say any more than that, but sheer speculation. Now let's hear the clean version.
One evening as the sun went down and the jungle fire was burning, down the track came a hobo hiking, and he said, "Boys, I'm not turning. I'm headed for a land that's far away beside the crystal fountain. So come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes and you sleep out every night, where the boxcars all are empty and the sun shines every day on the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings in the Big Rock Candy Mountains."
I wonder if R.J. Reynolds would love to get a hold of this song and use it to advertise cigarette trees. That would be great. More than 70 years later, McClintock's recording of the Big Rock Candy Mountains was featured in the soundtrack to the film O Brother, Where Art Thou? The soundtrack won a Grammy this year for Best Album, but hardly anyone attending the award ceremony realized the historical significance of the record made only a few miles away. The first country record recorded in Los Angeles was done at this session. California has always been known to be a melting pot of people migrating from different parts of the country. The artists who made country records there were no different. Although the Tennessee native Harry McClintock was the first hillbilly act to make records in California, he was by no means the first one here. One of the first and most popular radio acts in California was the Crockett family. Originally from West Virginia, the Crocketts, consisting of John, Dad Crockett, and his five sons, arrived in California in 1919. In 1923, they began performing string band instrumentals and cowboy songs on KMJ radio in Fresno. The group performed in minstrel shows at local theaters before moving to Los Angeles around 1927. It was there that they attended their first recording session for Brunswick in November 1928. String band recordings such as this were not heard too often in California recording studios, but that was one. In time, the Crockett family joined a national touring group for RKO and left California, making further recordings for Brunswick in Chicago and New York. But they had left their mark on California country music. In October 1928, Hal Roach signed an agreement with Victor to install sound recording equipment on the Roach lot in Culver City. The installation began the following March, at which time the Roach Studios began making its first talking pictures. Victor was used to record sound on disc, and Western Electric System was used for optical sound recording on film. For a brief time, Victor held some of its recording sessions at the Roach Studios, including an appearance by Jules Verne Allen, one of the first singers who had actually been a working cowboy. Allen had first recorded for Victor in El Paso, Texas in April 1928, but by 1929 he was broadcasting on KFI and KNX in Los Angeles, and Victor took advantage of the opportunity to make records, billing Allen as the original singing cowboy. Allen's recordings are considered by folklorists as being prime examples of authentic traditional cowboy songs.
Come all you young waddies, I'll sing you a song. Stand back from the wagon, stay where you belong. I've heard you observing, I'm fussy and slow. While you're punching cattle, I'm punching the dough.
As we've heard so far, radio played a major role in the popularization of hillbilly music in California. Most recording artists were already popular on radio when they made their first records. With the advent of talking pictures in the late 1920s, movies entered into the mix as well. More so than in New York, motion pictures, whose base of operations was in Hollywood, had a major effect on the recording industry. In 1930, a new genre was launched when the first movie-singing cowboy made his first records. Ken Maynard was born in Texas and worked as a ranch hand before joining the Kit Carson Traveling Show and then the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. He began his film career acting in silent westerns, but when sound came in, Maynard was the first cowboy to sing and strum a guitar, which he did in the film Wagon Master. In March 1930, Maynard recorded 8 songs at Columbia's Hollywood Studios. Only one disc was issued, which included this version of an occupational song he learned while he was working on the range.
Oh, I am a lonely cowboy, and I'm off on the Texas train. My train is cinching saddles and pulling bridle reins. But I can twist the lasso with the greatest skill and ease. Or rope and ride a bronco most anywhere I please. Oh, I love the rolling prairie that's far from trail and stride. I'm a bunch of longhorns, I'll journey all my life. But if I had a stink boy, soon mad I would be. To the sweetest girl in this wide world just fell in love with me.
It's a shame he didn't record more. He also played fiddle in some of his films. And also note that this was issued on the Pop series and not on the standard Hillbilly series, which was in the 15,000 series. Maynard's work in films showed for the first time that Hollywood could be combined with traditional cowboy music. But an even more important event occurred in 1930 on radio station KMPC, something that only could have happened in Hollywood. The Depression had flattened Los Angeles, both financially as well as spiritually, and station management decided that they needed to inject some excitement into its programming and lift the spirit of its audience. It was station manager Glenn Rice's idea to convince listeners that he had discovered a group of hillbillies who had been isolated in the wilds of the Santa Monica Mountains and persuaded them to perform on radio. Now, in actuality, what happened was Rice had hired Leo Manis, a local performer, and 2 musicians currently appearing on KFI's Saturday Night Jamboree, Tom Murray, who was also an actor, and Cyprian Paulette, to masquerade as the Backwoods group, which was christened the Beverly Hillbillies. In March 1930, Rice excitedly announced his discovery of the hill folk on the air, who, according to the script, had been out of touch with civilization for 100 years. Radio ploys such as this have since become commonplace, but the excitement generated by the buildup to the Hillbillies' actual first appearance on KMPC created an uproar. Leo Manis became better known as Zeke Manners.
Started with the, in the beginning, there was the Beverly Hillbillies. Let's start there.
Okay.
You know. And there was Pappy, who was Tom Murray, Ezra, who was Ezra the First, who was Cyprian Paulette from KFI. He was the singer from KFI. And myself. And then we were joined by Elton Britt. Or Jad could have been the next guy that we brought in. He was, that's Ashley Bees. And then a fellow who played Lem. And Lem Giles is what we call him. His real name was Steve Hansen. Was a guitar picker.
Steve, I've seen the name Aleph.
Who?
Aleph Hansen.
Yeah, Aleph, that's right. It was a, that's right. You're right. It was a Swedish name.
Aleph Hansen, and you called him Lem Giles?
That's right.
And was Hank Skillet, was that Henry Blayholder?
Henry Blayholder, right. And his brother was with the St. Louis Browns. And he was a tall, husky guy, and he looked like a blacksmith, and a very good fiddler. That's right, that's the original Beverly Hillbillies.
As a footnote, when the CBS television comedy The Beverly Hillbillies made its debut in 1962, Sam, take note, Zeke Manners sued for infringement on the name, which he had astutely copyrighted, and he won. I think that he also became musical director for the soundtrack album to the TV show as part of the settlement, so he got some good royalties after that. Zeke was a smart man. On April 6, 1930, an inconspicuous announcement in the Los Angeles Times radio log signaled the arrival of the Beverly Hillbillies. They were an immediate hit. In short order, they added a fiddler and were signed to Brunswick Records. Less than 3 weeks after their radio debut, the group made their first recordings.
To most folks, there's a spot that lives forever. Deep down within their fondest memory, though I have been a rover, I have never seen any place where I would rather be. When it's roundup time in Texas, and the bloom is on the sage, then I long to be in Texas, back a riding on the range, just to smell the bacon frying when it's sizzling in the pan, hear the breakfast horn in the early morn, drinking coffee from a can, just a riding, rocking, roping, pounding leather all day long, just a swaying, sweating, swearing, listening to a cowhand song, how it beckons, and I reckon I would work for any wage, just to be again, to be free again, where the bloom is on the sage.
Just to show that we always learn something new, now I know about the phantom cactus from Arizona. The difference between the Beverly Hillbillies sound and the cowboy music that had been recorded up to that time was startling. For the first time, smooth vocal harmonies were associated with songs about the West. Their repertoire consisted of newly written, polished compositions penned by the seasoned Tin Pan Alley songwriting duo of Fred Howard and Nat Vincent. As a result, the Beverly Hillbillies became a sensation. Fred Howard and Nat Vincent were known on Los Angeles radio as the Happy Chappies, It's Fred on the left and Nat on the right. They had met while singing on San Francisco's KFRC, ironically appearing on the same radio program that featured Harry McClintock, the Blue Monday Jamboree. Nat Vincent had been writing hit songs in vaudeville since 1911. In the late 1920s, he began writing picturesque songs of the Old West, adapting a poem called The Strawberry Roan by Curly Fletcher to music and adding a chorus to it. That song was sung by Ken Maynard in a Western by the same name. Howard and Vincent created a new musical genre to fit the equally new singing cowboys of radio and movies at a time when Bob Nolan was a lifeguard, Gene Autry a struggling Jimmy Rogers imitator in Chicago, and Roy Rogers a truck driver. Nat Vincent's melodies and Fred Howard's lyrics created a new, uniquely American musical genre and not only helped romanticize the Hollywood West, but also perpetuated an idyllic view of California that helped spur the mass migration of Americans to the West during the Depression.
I was born in Iowa, down where the tall corn grows. Us from old Montana, Ma's from Indiana, how we got together, goodness knows. I have rambled around a bit till I settled down. Out in California, where the most unusual weather is sure to be found. Even though it may be raining, still the folks are not complaining. For the rain brings golden grain to California. Though a wintry wind is blowing in the mountains where it's snowing, still the golden poppies grow in California. Winter or fall, you'll find us all down a-bathing in the sea. Summer or spring, birds on the wing stop to raise a family, while the orange blossoms blooming seem to nod at you and say, make your mind up to wind up in sunny California.
I interviewed Nat Vincent shortly before his death at the age of 89 in 1979. He talked about the song that kicked off the recording career of the Beverly Hillbillies.
I went to Texas and for a roundup with the Cane Ranch and as a visit, and went out on the roundup, and the fields were just loaded with purple and golden sage flowers.
What year was that, Matt? Do you recall what year that was?
No, 1920. About 1928, I guess it was. And George Brown, who turned his name into Billy Hill, Hillbilly, mm-hmm. That wrote Wagon Train, the Last Roundup. Well, coming from there, he wrote the Last Roundup. I come back and wrote When the Bloom is on the Sage. I called my partner, Fred Howard, up, and I said, you want to write the second verse? I'll cut you in on this. And we laughed over the phone. I sang him the verse and chorus that I had written.
Now that was one of the first interviews that I ever did with this 89-year-old man who was blind by that time, who outlasted both of us that were there. I was there with another historian named Gene Baer at Nat's home in La Crescenta. And not only did he insist on giving longer answers than I expected, but he went over to the piano and sang and performed all of his major hits. Now, he was called Bubbles because he had a hand in writing I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles. So, play the next track.
I hear the most folks there's a spot that lives forever deep down within their fondest memory. Though I have been a rover, I have never seen any place where I would rather be. When it's roundup time in Texas and the bloom is on the sage, then I long to be in Texas, back riding on the range, just to smell the bacon frying when it's sizzling in the pan, hear the breakfast horn in the early morning, drinking coffee from a can, just riding, rocking, roping, pounding leather all day long, just a swing, sweating, swearing, listening to a cowhand song, how it beckons, and I reckon I would work for any wage to be free again, just to be again where the bloom is on the sage.
How's that for an 89-year-old blind man? And he even insisted on autographing the picture. The Happy Chappie songs, including When the Bloom is on the Sage, My Pretty Quadroon, and Me and My Burrow, helped make the Beverly Hillbillies a hit, and also influenced the songwriting of countless composers of Western-oriented material, most notably Bob Nolan of the Sons of the Pioneers. Country music not only became accepted on Los Angeles radio, it became in demand, and other groups followed. Another local outfit, Bill Simmons and his California Cowhands, recorded for Victor later in 1930, and used When the Bloom is on the Sage as a model for another song about California.
I'm dreaming of the mountains in a land that's far away, where there are crystal fountains and the world is bright and gay, where the sun is always shining. Was there I used to roam? Oh, I'm going back to that little old shack in my California home.
But not everyone who came to California to make hillbilly records used the Happy Chappie's music. One renegade who was America's most celebrated singer of hillbilly music arrived in Los Angeles in time to usher in Victor's new Hollywood studios, located at 7000 Santa Monica Boulevard. In 3 short years, Jimmy Rogers had done more to popularize hillbilly music than any other artist. His combination of hillbilly, blues, jazz, and Tin Pan Alley styles would make him the most popular and influential performer in country music history. On July 16, 1930, toward the end of a 2-week-long recording session for Victor, Rogers made the 9th in his successful series of blue yodels. But this time, his accompanist was a man who was as much of an icon in jazz as Rogers was in country. This is Jimmy Rogers with Louis Armstrong on cornet and Lil Hardin Armstrong on piano.
Standing on the corner, I didn't mean no harm. Along come a police, he took me by the arm. It was down in Memphis, corner of Beale and Main. He says, big boy, you'll have to tell me your name.
Despite the history-making session featuring the leaders of their respective genres, Jimmy Rogers' Blue Yodel No. 9 had little impact on the hillbilly music industry in California. Cowboys and hobos continued to rule the airwaves, and did so until World War II. Another singer and composer in the mold of Harry McClintock was the Texas-born Goebel Reeves, who eschewed his college studies to the dismay of his well-to-do parents, choosing instead the life of a hobo. On record, he called himself the Texas Drifter and made appearances on Los Angeles radio stations sporadically throughout the 1930s. Note the similarity of the song on this Brunswick recording to fellow hobo McClintock's Big Rock Candy Mountains.
I do, folks. This is station HOBO. Operating on a vacancy of from 30 to 90 days by authority of your local police force. We bring to you at this hour a little side door Pullman passenger we brought in off of last night's freight train. He got his guitar with him, and we're going to have him sing and play a little song for you. Come on over here, Drifter, and sing with folks, will you?
Yes, sir, Sap. I mean, Cap. Yes, I'm going to sing for him. What you want me to sing?
Well, just sing anything, boy, but start singing.
Yes, sir, you know, I'm going to tell you folks that I've really seen America first. For riding on a dirty freight train, been from the Frisco Golden Gates to the rock-bound coast of Maine. Now I've harvested wheat in Kansas, cut ice in Montreal. But the work I had done in Texas, my friend, was the worst job of them all. You know, I was riding on a dirty old freight train going into the painted west, when I swung down off in a western town with some very much needed rest. I'd been working hard up in Kansas, felt that I had earned a flop, but as I swung down off that train, I ran into a cop.
If you've never heard Goble Reeves before, you got to listen to more of his records, because he added a little twist to the Jimmy Rogers yodel. He trilling the notes and sweeping in and out, marvelous recordings. And he recorded for the McGregor transcription label in Los Angeles in the later 1930s. Throughout the 1930s, the Beverly Hillbillies continued to be one of the most popular attractions on Los Angeles radio. One of their members was Stuart Hamblin, born in Kellysville, Texas in 1908, who had appeared on KFI as Cowboy Joe before joining the Hillbillies in 1930. An early acquaintance of Hamblin's was singer Wesley Tuttle.
They were some great days. I started in this business here in 1933 on the old KMTR radio station with Stuart Hamblin, back when Stuart was a very young man and had just, he was well underway with his radio career, because he started out here in 1929. And
so you joined him, were the Beverly Hillbillies disbanded at that time, or they'd gone elsewhere?
No, Stuart had left them. In fact, that's one of his favorite stories. He didn't think too much of them, because he got sick, and while he was sick, they fired him and hired somebody else in his place. And that's when Stuart, he's very aggressive, as you know, and he said, I don't need them, I'll start my own. And he started the Lucky Stars, and then the Covered Wagon Jubilee, of course. And so that was... old Stuart, he took the bull by the horns.
Go ahead and play the next track.
I want to drink my java from an old can while the moon goes climbing high. I want to hear the song of the fall wheel. I want to hear the coyote cry. I want to feel a saddle horse between my legs, riding him out on the range. Just to kick him in the side, make him show a step and pride, back on the Texas plains. Each night in my dreams, somehow it seems that I'm back where I belong. Just a country hick, way back in the sticks, back where I was born. City life and city ways are driving me insane. I wanna be alone, I wanna be back home, back on my Texas plains.
Stuart Hamblin and his Covered Wagon Jubilee was the first country act to record for the new Decca label in 1934. On August 1st, American Decca was incorporated, and owner Jack Capp signed Hamblin to a contract. His first Decca records were made 2 days later. The Decca studios were built next door to the Paramount Film Studios lot at 5505 Melrose Avenue in Hollywood. As with his other studios in New York and Chicago, Cap installed the famous photograph of a statue of Pocahontas that his brother Dave had taken while on vacation in Jamestown, Virginia. He added the caption, "Where's the Melody?" as a warning to adventurous sidemen, and copyrighted the result as the Melody Princess. Stuart Hamblin got his revenge for his dismissal by the Beverly Hillbillies when his programs on KMTR and KNX overtook the Hillbillies in popularity. He moved to KFWB and became one of the most popular draws on the West Coast. This is a line of people waiting to come in and see his program. Hamblin became one of the chief architects of the Western sound in country music in the 1930s. Over his long career, his compositions such as Remember Me, This Old House, My Mary, and It Is No Secret became country music classics, only four of over 250 songs that he wrote. Hamblin became so popular that he even ran for president in 1952 on the Prohibition ticket. In later years, he would dryly remark that Eisenhower defeated him by a mere 24 million votes. Hamblin continued as a prominent Los Angeles radio personality with his program The Cowboy Church through the 1970s. But the most popular Western act of them all arrived on the scene in 1931 when Leonard Sly, a singer and yodeler from Duck Run, Ohio, put an ad in a Los Angeles newspaper looking to form a three-part harmony yodeling trio. The man who answered the ad was a Canadian named Bob Nolan, who would become the single most important songwriter of Western songs. Adding third member William Slumber Nichols, the group struggled, first as the Rocky Mountaineers and then as the Gold Star Rangers. In 1933, Sly, Nolan, and newest member Tim Spencer, Tim's on the left, who replaced Nichols, got a program on KFWB, competing directly with the Beverly Hillbillies on rival station KMPC. So from left to right is Tim Spencer, Bob Nolan, Hugh Farr, and Leonard Sly. And below is the sponsor and the announcer. Initially called the Pioneer Trio, they soon added a fourth member, hot fiddler Hugh Farr. A KFWB announcer, thinking that the group looked too young to be pioneers, announced them as the Sons of the Pioneers, and the name stuck. 5 days after Stuart Hamblin's first session with Decca, the Sons of the Pioneers made their first records as well. Only Hamblin and Bing Crosby had been recorded on the West Coast by Decca prior to the Pioneers' first session. On August 8, 1934, the Sons of the Pioneers recorded the first version of what would become their most famous tune.
I'm a roving cowboy, riding all day long. Tumbleweeds around me sing their lonely song. Nights underneath a prairie moon, I ride alone and sing a tune.
See them tumbling down, pledging their love to the ground. Lonely but free I'll be found, drifting along with the tumbling tumbleweed.
Shortly after the Sons of the Pioneers' first session for Decca, KFWB program director Gerald King signed the group to record for his new transcription company, Standard Radio. The 102 titles recorded were distributed nationally, launching the Pioneers' fame as the leaders of the West Coast country movement. They began appearing in B-Westerns for Columbia Pictures, starring Charles Starrett, until Leonard Sly left the group and adopted the name Roy Rogers. By 1936, Victor, Brunswick, and Decca all had made records on the West Coast, featuring cowboy and Western performers. Noticeably absent from this trend was the ARC conglomerate, whose country music base was still in the East. In May 1936, this all changed with the first recorded appearance by a Texas string band in California. The Lightcrust Doughboys had been a favorite of Fort Worth audiences since 1930, when it had Western Swing founders Milton Brown and Bob Wills as members. By 1935, its personnel had been completely revamped, and in 1936, they were signed to appear in a Western by the newest singing cowboy star, Gene Autry. Republic Pictures had initially wanted Milton Brown and his musical Brownies to be featured in Autry's upcoming Western, Oh Susanna. But Brown was killed after an auto accident in April, and as a result, the Doughboys were selected as the Brownies' replacement. Group member Zeke Campbell had recently joined the band as its lead guitarist. Now we have a video.
The way you won the games in such overwhelming fashion.
Man, he wasn't even there.
What'd you do in the movie?
Well, we
Preservation?
Took us in the studio, and they had a guy named Fleming Allen. I'll never will forget him. He was a songwriter, and he wrote several songs, and we did a lot of rehearsing, you know, and some of the songs that he wrote. They were all Western type things. We rehearsed a lot, and they took us around all over the studio and showed us the procedure of making movies and everything. Real nice to us. And then we went in the studio, in the musical studio, sound studio, and made all the music there beforehand. And then when we did the scenes, like on the chuck wagon of the stagecoach or whatever out on the patio of the ranch, we just pantomimed. They played it back to us. We pantomimed to us. But you couldn't tell the difference because we knew, you know, we played that stuff so much we knew what we were doing.
How can you pantomime a hot takeoff?
But it's amazing because, like us, but it had so much better quality by recording in a sound studio.
That was an amplified, unamplified guitar that Zeke Campbell was playing, and the next year he would amplify and become one of the most astonishing electric guitarists in country and western swing history, influencing no less than Les Paul. No less than Les Paul. It's good. Uncle Zeke. And it wasn't referring to Zeke Campbell because that was recorded for by the Wanderers in Dallas in 1935 before Zeke Campbell was ever a member, so that's coincidental. Although the Lightcrust Doughboys only made one trip to California, theirs was the first recording session on the West Coast of what would become known as Western Swing. The now romantic image of the cowboy, which had morphed with Hollywood's Westerns and the national dance band craze, helped define Western Swing for depression-weary Californians. After World War II, it became the most popular form of country music entertainment on the West Coast. Despite his association with the West, due to his successful run of motion pictures for Republic, Gene Autry did not make recordings in Los Angeles until 1937. He had been a recording artist since 1929, first as a Jimmy Rogers imitator for Victor, and then as one of the stars of WLS Chicago's National Barn Dance. With his increased presence in films in Hollywood, it became necessary for Autry to begin recording there as well, combining his cowboy image with the danceable Western music being popularized by the Sons of the Pioneers and the Lightcrust Doughboys.
Oh, listen to that rhythm of the rain, reeling, rocking rhythm of the rain. You've heard that old bazooka and the king of jazz, but have you felt the tickle that the strange rhythm has? Dancing to the rhythm of the rain, reeling, rocking rhythm of the rain. Grandpa burned his crutches and won't stay at home. Since this rural rhythm has got in his bones, and he's dancing to the rhythm, rootin' tootin' rhythm, dancing to the rhythm of the rain.
The 1930s saw a wave of Americans migrate to the West because of the financial destruction to the rest of the country caused by the Depression and the simultaneous disaster known as the Dust Bowl. A folk singer from Okemah, Oklahoma, named Woody Guthrie, hoboed his way to Los Angeles, where he briefly appeared on radio before returning east to be discovered by folklorist Alan Lomax. From Alabama came a family that had been drawn to California by the fanciful stories they had heard about golden fruit hanging from trees, waiting to be picked. After getting weary of the drudgery of being sharecroppers, three members of the family entered a contest on radio station KFBK in Sacramento in 1940. They won first prize, which was their own regular radio program. This is Rose Maddox from a guest shot on a radio program I hosted in 1985. And please forgive the amateurish photography. At least one of them. We have two cameras on this. And one couldn't keep still.
Get your instruments then.
Cal had made enough money picking cotton and fruit to order a $7 guitar from Sears and Roebuck. And my brother Cliff already had a guitar. He brought it from Alabama. And he taught Cal to play guitar. And we'd be sitting around the campfires out in the fields at night, you know, after work was all done. picking and singing, and Fred decided he didn't want to pick cotton for a living anymore. He didn't want to work for a living, he said.
Get into the music business.
Yeah, so he told him, said, let's go into the music business. And this girl said, how do you get in the music business? And Fred says, well, I don't know, but I'm going to find out. He said, I'll do the MC work and all of that kind of stuff, and I'll get us a sponsor for the radio. And none of us had ever been in a radio station. We didn't even know what a microphone looked like, you know. And, of course, we was out in the cotton field and sitting around the campfire, and we didn't say, they said, because I didn't know I was included in it at the time. And they said, well, they didn't care, you know. So the next day, him and Mama went to a furniture store in Modesto, Rice Furniture. I think it's still there, too. And talked them into sponsoring us on a radio show, KTRB in Modesto. That there was one stipulation. They had a girl, they had to have a girl singer in the group.
Oh, really?
And Fred wasn't about to lose that opportunity and go back into the cotton field. He just says, we got the greatest girl singer that's ever been. He had no idea.
That you were.
No, he had no idea who he was going to get even. And it dawned on him all of a sudden that his little 11-year-old sister was driving him all crazy, singing constantly. And so they took me, and I went on the radio with them. And that's when it started.
It's a lot cleaner than that. I don't understand why.
Let's go, Walt.
Yes, sir, folks, and it is them, our famous outlaws, the Maddox Brothers and Rose.
Oh, you tell.
Straight from the hills of Alabama. We're going to try to entertain you here for a little while, and we do hope you
yeah.
Are.
Yes, sir, and howdy, folks. How are y'all out there about this time of day? And give us a great big smile, will you? Yes, sir, a great big smile. And I'll introduce the boys and the girls here. This year is Fred, your announcer, talking, the master of ceremony, either one. And here's Cal over here, there's guitar. Howdy, Cal.
Well, hello there, Fred.
And come here, Rose.
How are you?
Just tolerable, I guess. How about you speaking to the folks?
Howdy, folks.
Yes, sir. And let's start off here the little song we composed yourself. Cal wrote this year a number, and it's going to be A Cowboy Has to Yell.
Yippee-yay, yippee-o, and away to town we go. For a cowboy has to sing, and a cowboy has to yell.
Yee-haw!
Or his heart would break inside of him at the gates of the home corral. Ali-o-lo,
the Maddox Brothers and Rose would become one of the most uninhibited and exciting bands on West Coast radio, playing everything from early honky-tonk to rockabilly. And thank you to Chris Strachwitz for releasing the album that had that broadcast on it. Finally, we come to the group that made Western Swing a national phenomenon. Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys had been Oklahoma's most popular radio act since 1934, when they were driven out of Texas by the Light Crust Doughboys' tyrannical manager, W. Leo Daniel. Finding a home in Tulsa, Wills not only had the top Western swing band after Milton Brown's death, his records for Brunswick ARC were the label's bestsellers in their folk hillbilly catalog. In 1940, Wills and members of his band began appearing in B-Westerns, filming them in California. Steel guitarist Leon McAuliffe was in many of them.
I was in a total of 12, I guess, in one short subject. The first one was with Tex Ritter called Take Me Back to Oklahoma. That was done in 1940 for Monogram Studios, and it was what we called a B picture. And then the next one was made in 41, and this was for Columbia Pictures, and this had a big star, Glenn Ford, in it, and had Ann Miller, Penny Singleton, Charlie Ruggles, some really big stars in those days, and it was an A Western. It was a big one. And then in 42, we came back and did 8 more B Westerns for Columbia with a fellow named Russell Hayden. And I was in every one of those. Now in the big movie, they used Bob Wills' whole band. In the first one, they only used 5 men. In the B pictures, they used about 5 men. I was fortunately one of the 5 that Bob took with him. And in those movies, we got to ride horses and fight and shoot and have lines, and as well as play and sing. And yes, the movies were very, very popular. They were a great box office everywhere they went.
All right, let's hope it plays.
In the pile of fun, the great clock on the mantel saying it's getting late. Curtains on the windows, snow are white. Parlor is pleasant on Sunday night.
Picture. I read, I'm plumb full of that I read.
She'd set me free. She lived so long till her head got bald. She'd taken the notion not to die at all.
I'd read, I'm plumb full about I'd read.
We'll just listen. Movies rentable.
Lamp on the table, picture on the wall, there's a pretty sofa, and that's not all. I'm not mistaken, I'm sure I'm right, somebody else in the parlor tonight.
I read, I'm plumb full about I read.
Tray pecking out dough, granny, will you dog bite? No jaw, no. Hurry up, boys, don't fool around. Grab your partner and clog on down.
I'd read, I'm fumbled about I'd read.
Okay, it's a great clip.
When can we get that tape?
Gene, do you know? You know where to get the Bob Wills shorts? This is the feature.
That's on the Bear Family.
Is it? The video is?
Not that tune. Maybe
this is the only complete tune in the movie, I think, that really showed them all. Okay.
Is that from Go West?
That's from this movie right here, yeah. Tommy Duncan. Yeah, that's Tommy Duncan. And both Bob and Tommy were in the foreground wearing very, very false mustaches. At the end of 1942, Bob Wills broke up his band and enlisted in the U.S. Army, effectively ending the pre-war years of California's country music movement. When Wills was discharged the next year, he spearheaded the massive popularity of country music in California as more and more local Western swing bands were started by artists such as Spade Cooley and Tex Williams. In Bakersfield, a new kind of country music was germinating, as a response to the increased citifying of the country sound in Nashville. Pasadena's KXLA became the first radio station to adopt an all-country music format. Capitol Records became the first major record label headquartered on the West Coast, assembling an impressive lineup of country talent. But that's for another time.
This station's programs come to you from Station HOBO, my friends. This is the Ball and Chain Hookup, the coast-to-coast guesswork. We release the air now to Station JAIL, and good night.
Thank you. What's that? Yes.
Could you tell us about
sure.
That?
You know, but it's not country.
Tape, it might, clear the head.
Well, we want Bill to come on and do his thing, so if anyone wants to hang around after and see the video, they
Carrie
can.
Carrie has a radio show he's going to tell you about briefly?
It's not country. I did country music for 11 years in the San Fernando Valley, but since 1994, I've been hosting a blues show and a jazz show back-to-back on KCLU, and it can be heard anywhere in the world at www.kclu.org Pacific Coast time, 5 to 8 p.m. on Sundays. So I'll be there day after tomorrow. Yeah, any other questions? It was called Carrie's Country Store on KCSN. Those were the studios that you almost saw with with Rose Maddox. But it's best you didn't see them. They were pretty crummy. 1987, I stopped it. Yeah, but I had a lot of Western pioneers on the show, most of whom, if not all of whom, are gone now. So I'm Hank Penny, Jimmy Wakely, I mean, Art Satherly of Columbia ARC. I interviewed him. A lot of people. He started with the Beverly Hillbillies, I think, when he was 14 or 15 and became a star on his own. I am not familiar with his radio work out here. Any other questions? Okay, bring on the main event.